Welcome, thank you all for coming out for the ninth book about Quinn Coulson. Which I gotta be careful because I don't want to give it away like always, but I think it's the best one so far. It's different a little bit, and it's layers and then it's detail. When I get his books, I read the first page and the last page.
And that's it. That's all he does. That's it.
I have no idea what's in here. But the book is, the last book was a little more countryfied silliness.
Yeah.
This one's a little bit more serious.
It's a serious book, yeah, for sure.
Quinn Coulson is married. That's no secret, right?
Yep.
And there are two girls from New York who are podcasters, have a podcast called Thin Air. And they get wind of a potential case that was never solved in Tippahaw County 23 years later. So they get the idea to come down to Jericho to investigate. Now, this is a family affair. This is Quinn, his wife, Maggie, and her son, Brandon. Brandon is named after the victim who was a kid who shot himself in a field while hunting. Doesn't make any sense. Uncle Hemp, who was the sheriff before Quinn, is brought up, disparaged, and drug around through the mud a bunch. There's a lot going on here. It is a family event, and these podcasters want the story. So these two girls go into Jericho, Mississippi, which doesn't exist, but you know it does, to find answers. And they're not shy. One of them has blue hair, which plays big in North Mississippi. So you've got all these components going on. You've got the references to Quinn's daddy, the stuntman, Jason Coulson, who is often referred to. So the family members here are all brought into this. Caddy, his sister, is a player. They come to Memphis. It's a lot of moving parts, but they all work, as you know they always do. This one, though, I think that, in my opinion, not to compare or to the inspiration that guys like you pick up along the way, I think is subconscious. You've read your entire life, but in these pages, there's Ace, and your phone is gonna be shot in about 10 seconds. Ace is heavily armed.
She's a friend of mine, it's okay.
Okay.
Not anymore.
Ex-friend. James Lee Burke, one of our favorites, I believe, any of us who read. The book is very Burkean in places. I think that and Elmore Leonard, who you knew and who inspired you for a long time.
Sure, of course.
So there are new layers of detail and of nuance and of explaining things that I think give it more depth, and you can't really stop turning the pages. You've already bought it, so you'll be turning the pages. It's really good, and I think it's maybe the best Quinn Coulson novel ever. It took 9 times, for Christ's sake, so it's about time. Welcome, great to see you as always. We've been drinking since noon, so here's Ace to say something before I get it back.
Well, thanks, Drake, and thank you guys for coming out on a rainy night. Greatly, greatly appreciate it. Some very familiar faces, some new faces, and this is terrific. It's always good to talk about these books here in Memphis because I think you guys get these books more than when I go out and talk in California and I do other talks other places. I don't have to explain to you about the South. I don't have to tell you about these characters. You guys know these people. They are sometimes
you
people
are
you
people.
Have... You have well, I wouldn't go that far.
That one over there...
It depends on which side of the road in Jericho that you live.
Well,
I think
still.
that but you guys know these people, and I know these people, and these people are, you know, family members, and they're friends, and they're people that I've run across that I like very much, and they're people that have frustrated me a great deal. But I think that you guys definitely get it, and I think that's what's so fun about talking about this stuff here. This is the 9th book. I cannot believe it. I've been doing this for almost 10 years. I'm going to be starting next month working on the 10th Quinn book, and I'm very excited about it. And I think what's fun for me, and I hope it's fun for you guys, is that
mic up a little bit.
You know, that you get to see this area grow and change, and you get to see these characters, you know, they're characters that we've met early on in the story that have come on to Tippecanoe County, and they've left. Some people have died. There have been new people that have been born. They come in, and I mean, that's the fun for me writing about this. This is like my little sandbox to write about Tippecanoe County and to see these people that are changing and the world that's coming about. And I think you know, Quinn is somebody. Sometimes I think about, you know, writing and what's the importance of writing kind of a hero-driven book. You know, what's the point? Is it for entertainment? Is it just to get you guys to read a thriller and turning the pages? But for me, I think, you know, I'm not Quinn Colson. I'm not, you know, it's a character I write. But I think these kind of examples, it's like watching old westerns, watching movies of people that we idolize. You know, we kind of need a good, strong kind of moral figure in these times to kind of navigate the period that we're living in.
Some things don't change, but some things do change. The things that don't change in Mississippi are emphasized in this book profoundly, maybe more than ever. Do you spend more time on this than the last one or not?
I had a little extra time this time, yeah.
The corrupt nature of Mississippi, who is second to only Louisiana in many
categories.
No,
let me correct you. A lot of polls will say Mississippi is number one in corruption.
And we live
and
there,
take
and
a lot
we're
of
proud of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. He lives there, I live there, and could be prouder. But the corruptness of the politicians is emphasized here in a subtle way, but it doesn't require being subtle because it's so gosh damn obvious.
Yeah.
So they're interwoven into everything, as always. The senators and all of these people who don't want no gentlemen's clubs, and how dare we put up a place where women might dance naked. So the answer is to put up a giant cross to block it.
That's right. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
As are the signs outside Vienna's, which is still run by Miss Fanny Hathcock. Some of the signs that were that are in the book are, we fired the ugly one, come on in, and support single mothers.
Don't say the one that you wanted me to put in the next book.
Why?
Well, go ahead, what the hell?
I saw one once that said.
I'm not taking responsibility for this.
It'll be in the next book, I guarantee you. Don't be a loner with a boner. I'm really sorry. But I just loved it. I had to bring it up. I want credit for that in the book.
You will.
Quinn in this book is more dominant and more under control as the chaos around him swirls, and he is linked to the suicide and the of this kid.
Yeah.
And then they go looking, and these two girls from New York are interviewing people in this small town and looking for answers. And it's and then his dad keeps coming up, and his uncle Hank Beckett, who was the sheriff before he was, keeps coming up. So they swirl around and around and around, and you don't, I'm not really sure what's going on. And there's some good killing.
Yeah.
Thanks. A lot of it.
Thanks.
But it is one that you really, it's more complex, I believe. There are many narratives intersecting in places. And Quinn's always the cool head. Lily Virgil, the nicest mouth in America.
Sure, of course.
For a chick, nice mouth.
Yeah.
She's a part of the Marshall Service out at Oxford.
Yeah.
But she comes to help.
Right.
And you don't mess with her either.
No. Uh-huh.
So she assists him, and his new wife is there for support, and Caddy, his sister, and his mom. There's a thing in here The kid that is the killed himself allegedly, and his new wife's son had the same name. If you ever write a book again with two names, a guy with two names, right. Brandon,
yeah,
I may have to leave you. It's it's very confusing, but it is a dynamic change.
Sure. Well, you know, Faulkner had that with Sound the Fury with multiple Quentin Compsons, you know, where you had to follow who was who, and, you know, that's something.
You've got to kind of read back and go, Brendan Hitch.
Yeah, you've got to kind of figure that out, who's who, and there's also two Jason Colsons as well.
That's right.
So
Daddy
those,
and yeah.
Those lineages.
Caddy's son, yeah.
Yeah, but that's, again, I mean, that's what the fun for me is to write about this world, and I was really inspired when I first started writing these books. You're supposed to, when you go out on book tour, is to say, look, you can pick up these books at any point, and you can read them and enjoy them. That's what you want to do. But what I really hoped to do when I first started writing these books almost 10 years ago was to have a character and a world that would change, evolve, and grow, and that would have an interconnected story. So what you're talking about, all these threads that are in The Shameless, this stuff has been brewing for a long time. I mean, these characters, like this Vardaman character, who really represents what I think is the worst of the South. I mean, if you guys know your Mississippi history, you know the name Vardaman, and you know who he is and what that is. And this is the second coming of that guy. And I think, you know, I watch shows like Deadwood. I don't know if y'all watch Deadwood, but I love that show. I just thought it was fantastic. And I like to see, you know, you knew when, you know, Hearst came to town, you know how things were going to change. And I loved the character of Bullock, and I liked the Law and Order and this connection with Swearingen. And I think I wanted to create something that was interconnected, not just a hero book that every time that there was something different, there was a brand new story. I wanted something to really reward readers. So this particular novel is a culmination of things that have been going on for a long time. And now going into the 10th book, you know, to really steal a literary phrase to talk, you know, if we're speaking among the very literate, the shit is about to hit the fan.
Drake's a bad influence.
Oh, no. No, he acts real nice, please. Yeah, I wanted to bring up that word, too. I have suggested and written letters to Oxford and to Merriam-Webster, suggesting that there's a bird indigenous to Mississippi called the shit bird. Because the word is used in this book copiously. So perhaps they will listen to...
It's actually the state bird of Mississippi.
And that's perfect.
Yeah.
You talk about change among the characters.
Yeah.
Page 112. Maybe they change. Maybe the state doesn't. The whole county tries to act like it's all Mayberry, Main Street, USA. There's a streak of mean that's been there since the town was settled. You know, they lynched a black guy here in 77 and no one said a damn thing. It's not a civilized place, and I doubt anything has changed. The characters change, but you can drive the roads of that place as you do. You're in Oxford, I'm in South Haven, and somewhere betwixt, there's a lot of ugly madness going on statewide, politically. And preferences don't matter right now, they're in a book. But Jesus, the corruption at the county and state level in that place are a microcosm of a lot of other things. And you don't hesitate to bring that up, not in a judgmental way, just fact.
Yeah. I think we're entering a stage which is kind of scary in America, where we're seeing the death of newspapers and seeing journalists that are out of work. And I used to be a journalist for many years. That's how I became a writer, being a newspaper writer. And one of the things that we did when I worked in Florida was to check the books on these people and look over to see what they were doing, to see how our county budget was being spent, and, you know, where our tax dollars being utilized well. You know, were our elected officials taking money to go on trips to Las Vegas and that kind of thing. And that stuff's gone now. You know, the fact-checking, the watchdog stuff. And so we've really entered a golden age of corruption. And so we get, you know, we get where people, if they don't like something, you get in this world of like alternative facts, or I'm going to dispute this or whatever. But, you know, that's what this book is about. This is what The Shameless is about, is there are facts and there are lies. There's truth and there's morality, and that's why I have a character like Quinn Colson, who's kind of a guy cut from the same cloth as somebody like Gary Cooper, where you see, you know, what's happening in the world. Is this the right thing to do, or is this the wrong thing to do? Are we staying on the moral side or the immoral side? It's not really that tough to see, and it's a strange world we're living in where people debate those things. But I think what you're talking about, corruption, is I think it's a good time to be an elected official. Nobody's checking the books.
Or the yard signs. God, they can stop. There's a few pages here that I want to refer to just for your future reading, because you have the books. Ace played football famously at Auburn and didn't play in the NFL because it's hard.
Yeah.
That wasn't a...
No, I know. It's the truth. It's the truth.
It's just hard. I played my 2 years and got out. There is a passage in here, and I dog-eared this, because Gene Colson, the mama, and Caddy, his sister, and Maggie, his wife, are at a football game watching young Jason play football. And the... is it 1, 2, 3, 4... pages, this goes on with, he's trying to explain what's happening in the football game. The snaps, the plays, the tackles, the moments of the football glory and or not. As the ladies sit in the crowd talking about this murder investigation, and it goes from paragraph to dialogue, dialogue to paragraph, and it makes your heart kind of speed up. It's a great 4 pages.
Oh, thanks.
And the dialogue is dead on, and it's this contrast of, let these kids play ball, you know, yay team, go team, while they're trying to dig deeper into this insanity that's going on, and it just bounces off walls.
Yeah.
But it all works, and it's a great 4 pages.
Thanks.
You played ball and haven't written much about it. Was it fun to write this and kind of look at that angle, and then the insanity of the family in the crowd watching this, yet discussing all that's going on?
You know, it's funny, I grew up in a football family. My dad was a professional football coach, spent my whole formative years working in the NFL. I mean, I've spent a lot of time around football, but it's something I've never really wanted to write about. God bless that guy for bringing us in. Thank you very much. You know, it's something I've never really wanted to, I think I'm just too familiar with it, but, you know, in small town South and in Mississippi or in Tennessee.
Sorry, oh, that's all right. Sorry.
That's okay. I'll send you the direct link.
Okay.
I think that you can't escape it. It's just a big deal. And you've got to have, I mean, football is just as big as going to church. And it is just a huge part of life. And it's something, when I grew up in Alabama, and I was in Alabama in high school and in college, was a huge part of just everyday society. So I like that. I like that part of the world that, you know, you go to football practice as part of what you do, and then on Sunday you go to church and whatever. And it's just part of the fabric and something you can't deny. But yeah, it's interesting you brought that up, though.
It's a real dichotomy of movement and word.
Yeah, but it's part of it's a big part of Tibahaw County, and a place that I'm very familiar with, and it's something I've never really wanted to write about. I've had people say, why don't you write this football book? And I got so mad years ago when I was a struggling writer, and I was trying to get a book published. This was 25 years ago, or whatever. And some guy who was a walk-on at Ohio State got a $1 million deal to write about his experiences, you know, as a walk-on at Ohio State. And that made me so damn mad, I couldn't believe it. I said, God, I'm doing the wrong thing. I'm trying to write a crime novel. You know, I should be writing something like that. But anyway, this book, again, I mean, I'm very proud to have written 9 books in this series, to have some kind of longevity with it. I had done a series early in my career, and I really took it as far as I could go, as far as 4 books. But when I came up with Quinn, it was something that I felt like I could continue doing for a long time. I mean, that's the thing about when I was a newspaper reporter, I used to cover the sheriff's office, and there's always somebody new walking in the door. There's always something that's going to happen. There's always something that's going to change. I was doing a TV show this morning, and it was just looking at what happened in Memphis just overnight. And somebody said, where do you get your ideas? And I said, did you just listen to the last 5 minutes? I mean, five people were shot last night. There's corruption. There's somebody. I mean, I really don't need that far to get inspiration here in the Mid-South. It's everywhere. But I do love writing about this area. I think Memphis is a very rich town to write about. I probably write about as many scenes in Memphis as I do in Mississippi. And I think that, it's just a weird place. I think it's something that people are fascinated by. I mean, people I hear from my readers that are in the UK or in Australia, and just the mention of the word Memphis, it just sets off the imagination. And in North Mississippi, it's just a storied place. So I'm very fortunate. Some of our favorite writers, which we were discussing earlier, you know, crime writers tend to take on their location, their place. One of our favorite writers, a guy named C.J. Box, he writes about Wyoming. Robert Craes, one of other favorite writers, writes about Los Angeles. James Lee Burke writes about deep in Louisiana. And some people talk about how, somebody asked me the other day, said, how different is, you know, the Mid-South and Mississippi from Louisiana and James Lee Burke? I said, it's about as different as you can get, or Joe Lansdale in Texas. So I hope that's what I'm doing, is I really claim this territory as my own. The Mid-South is my area. This is the place I want to. So if anyone tries to write about this area besides me and take it over, we're taking it out.
I think you said that I was a bit shocked, but these books are big in Europe. Australia?
Yeah.
What must they think of us? But they have heathen parts too.
Yeah. But I think they see themselves. I think it's a similarity. I mean, a lot of the same.
Or are they just
people
feeling better about themselves?
Maybe so.
Maybe it's that.
Maybe so.
Did you borrow or give an homage to Chuck Box about the big green truck getting messed up?
No. I know what you're talking about. There's always something in C.J. Box's books.
Joe always wrecks a truck.
No, this one was even worse. It was in one of the previous books, a couple of books ago, where Quinn was trying to intercept some bank robbers, and there was a guy who's a former military guy, and he blew up his truck with a RPG. And I mean, I think that's probably the most insulting thing you can do to a Southern man is blow up a truck. I mean, you just don't mess with that.
You don't
and
mess
he
with
loved
the
that truck.
Truck,
and so that comes up all the time. But it's just one truck, so it doesn't happen as much.
Yeah. And of course, we've got the great, the topless bar, which is, well, it's one of them classy ones by a truck stop. And even Johnny Stagg makes an appearance.
Yeah.
And Hemp Beckett's old deputy and partner, whose name is now escaping me, may be the skankiest thing you've ever written. Y'all will love him. He's a good boy.
Well, you know, the fun thing about being a writer is, you know, there are people that piss us all off. And there are people that you run across in life and you go, boy, that guy's a real SOB I ran across.
E.J. Royce.
And he is just a terrible guy. And a few years ago, I had a run-in with a guy who was doing some work for me. And he was just, I won't go into the whole story, but he's just a despicable person. And he just started mouthing off about this and that. And he was just a terrible racist and having this. And just exuded a quality of evilness just being around him. And it just made me mad. You know, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and go, God, I can't believe I paid that guy to do work for me. I mean, this guy's just a real son of a bitch. I can't believe it. And the more he bothered me, I realized, you know what? I'm going to make sure that he earns his damn money that I paid him, and I'm going to put that guy in a book. And he ended up becoming one of the most despicable people in Tippahaw County. And of course, I changed his name to protect me from the lawsuits and that kind of thing. Of course, not this guy.
That's
would ever.
Fun.
This guy would never read a book in a million years. You know, he doesn't know. He's never opened a book in his life. But I put him in the book. I put him in The Forsaken. That's when we first meet him. And he's a guy who was a deputy. You know, you guys know Quinn Colson. And Quinn Colson's uncle years ago had been the sheriff of Tippahaw County for many years, and he's the keeper of all the secrets, and E.J. Royce was his first in command.
Boy.
So Quinn, when he's got to get down and dirty and try to find out what happened in Tippahaw County years ago, he's got to go back to E.J. Royce, and E.J. Royce is just a despicable character. But I don't want to you know, tip anybody off, but there is a very satisfying conclusion to J. Roy's story. And he really, I agree with you.
Yeah.
It's just one of the worst of the worst.
So where do you go in your mind when you write these really nasty, this guy's a nasty, I mean, do you have to sit back and go, and reference the guy that worked on your house that you wanted to cut his throat, and in lieu of that, you go for this dude? Because, I mean, the character descriptions and the character development of these people takes a little bit of time. This guy was, I mean, really just, he made you feel icky from just reading the book.
Sure.
And he's these two girls from New York looking for answers and showing up with, you know, microphones like this obscene thing. And he tries to get them to sit on his lap and call him Papa and stuff and drink this this homemade whiskey. And that dog won't hunt. They're going, Jesus, get me out of here.
Yeah, that's another part of the fun of this book. And there, you know, there's certainly dark threads that I go in this book, but I think there are some funny parts to it as well. But you can imagine taking somebody who is from, you know, from New York City, never really got out, especially younger people probably from Brooklyn or hipster kids, and then dropping them into rural Mississippi. And it's like for them, you know, it's like they've just landed on Mars and trying to assimilate. And so that's kind
of
the way. I
live there every day of my life.
You know how it is. And so that was the fun for me, is to see people's point of view of how Tippahaw County, for people who live here, how they understand it. They, you know, you guys don't have to have a learning curve, but for them coming in, these two women that are looking into this murder that happened 20 years ago, they're trying to figure it out, not only just what had happened, but also the town, the dynamics, what people are saying. And you guys know how it is. I mean, in Mississippi, I mean, if I wrote phonetically the way some people talk, nobody would understand what the hell I was talking about. I mean, there are people, you know, there are accents, and then there are accents, you know, and I think that for some people it really it confuses them. But again, you know, I think that's kind of what we got here, is, you know, I tell people about the South, it's the good, the bad, and the ugly. And, you know, it's what Faulkner said, you know, his character, I love it and I hate it, I love it, I hate it. And there's just, you know, I was driving up, you know, today, and it was just beautiful. You know, come up and the kudzu's grown on the hills, and it's kind of misty and gorgeous. I'm driving through, and there's little lakes and rivers and beautiful forests and all that kind of stuff. And then you go up another patch, and it's just completely logged out and been destroyed. And but it's a rich thing, you know, it's a rich history, and there's a lot of wonderful things about it, but certainly some corrupt things that need attention.
The next Spencer book will be out in November, as Ace continues to write that series about Spencer, and hopefully Hawk and Susan and Henry and Zebulon Sixkill and the characters make up that great series from Boston that will go on, I hope, for a bit longer.
There we go.
And then Quinn will continue with book 10. The possibilities of where this can go are unlimited. I mean, look at the state we live in. I mean, it's there's a lot. There's a great part in this where a caddy brings one of the girls up to Memphis. They end up at the Lamplighter, so she sees Midtown. So you got Midtown, you got North Mississippi, and you've got a potpourri of humanity that is likely needs to be killed.
Yeah.
But that's what makes books great, is how you handle them. So thank you, as always, for being here. Let's do some questions.
There we go.
Ask away. Yes, sir.
For years, I've been intrigued by how an author would choose an opening quote. Some of the best reading sometimes, regardless of how good the book is what you read. How did you come upon Robert Penhorn's at the beginning? Did that come after you started the book, or was it?
I think you were asking the question about the opening quotes of the book. You know, most authors begin, you know, with just something to kind of set the tone from a song or a poem or whatever, and I chose something from All the King's Men. That book, to me, is maybe the greatest book I've ever read in my life. And if you have not read All the King's Men by Robert Penhorn, as far as just what I'd call classic, amazing Southern literature, you know, I look at that book and it is just a powerhouse of a novel, and it's about politics, it's about corruption, it's about greed, it's about everything. It's about every damn thing in the world. And so I thought about that. It's talking really about the facade and about lying to the people and about,
you know, truth and lies and everything that I kind of wanted to, that's a really good question, is kind of what I wanted to establish with this novel. And so that came to me pretty damn quickly. I think before I even wrote page one, I was like, this is what I want to go for, you know. But that book, you know, I read that, I'll reread that book and I'm just knocked out by it, you know.
I have to go back to it. It's been years and years, but I remember thinking the same thing. It's fabulous.
It is. There's books like that, like All the King's Men and, you know, Deliverance by James Dickey. And I go back and, as a writer, I go back and say, God, how did these guys do this? How did they accomplish something like that? It's just towering. It really is.
There are also several moments here. I don't recall all these books, but biblical moments that give power to some of these pages. Fools give full vent to their rage, but the wise bring calm in the end, from Proverbs. There's a couple of those in here. Why'd you do that?
You know, I have to admit, my biblical references and my religious references go back to my wife, who has a better training in the church than I do. She grew up in a very, very strict religious household. So anytime I need a Bible verse or something like that, I just call on her very quickly to do it. So I would love to tell you that I'm that well versed in the Bible and I can.
Is she credited in the book?
But I think it's just part of it. I mean, it's part of the Deep South. No, she's not credited at all. I'm not going to. But I think that for me, it's, you know, again, it's you know, it's football, it's politics, it's religion, it's all of it. You know.
That kind of sums up the South. Yeah. Questions for Mr. Atkins? He has all the answers. Go ahead.
Patsy Brumfield, that's who the book is dedicated to. I'm not familiar with the name. Can you talk about her for a minute?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I saw her last night. Patsy Brumfield, the book is dedicated to her. She is a journalist in Mississippi. She worked for the Clarion Ledger. She's worked for other newspapers in the South for many years and knows politics, corruption. She basically knows where all the bodies are buried in Mississippi. And so when I was going to do a book about a gubernatorial election and what was happening, I called Patsy and I said, can you help me? And so we hung out in Jackson for a while. We went to the Capitol. She helped me, like, you know, we went to, there's just places where kind of the politicos and lobbyists and the bottom feeders kind of hang out in Jackson. And I said, Patsy, show me where this stuff happens. Where do the real deals get made off the floor? You know, who has this? Who's controlling what? Who's controlling the money strings? But she's a great person, and she just knows everything. Smart as a whip, wonderful, generous, and I could not have written this book without her, so thanks for asking that.
On that note, there is an event in this book called The Good Old Boy. I want you to explain this. The title, I mean, it's exaggerated, but not really.
Yeah.
It's where the politicians running for office and the swine that intermingle and put money in their pocket, and they walk around drinking free drinks, and this is a bunch of guys that are security, the Nazi bunch kind of walking around, the white supremacists, all gathering in one room to drink and commiserate. It's a hell of a picture, and probably not untrue.
Yeah, one of the other things I did last year was kind of getting into the flavor and the mood of this book, was I went down to the Neshoba County Fair. How many of you guys have been to the Neshoba County Fair? Y'all know the Neshoba County Fair. And part of it is a lot of fun. There's barbecue and there's horse racing and there's all kinds of stuff and fellowship and a lot of fun stuff. But there's also the political stump speeches. And so getting to watch the political stump speeches and whatever was very entertaining. And I got probably about, you know, 100 pages of notes from just watching these people stepping up and what they had to say. And kind of on the periphery, which was strange to me, was there were some kind of paramilitary guys that were hanging about, that were kind of politically active, that were tied in with some of the candidates. And I found that just completely bizarre and strange. But they were on the periphery. And so I just, it was like, you know, shoot fish in a barrel to see these characters and to see what was going on. And so, again, you know, it's just very, very odd times that we're living in. I think when I first started writing The Ranger, I think there was kind of, this is about 10 years ago, people were a little bit more subdued. And I wrote about some people that had some very extreme beliefs, extreme things that were going on. and they kind of kept to themselves. They were out in the woods. They were kind of doing their own thing. And a friend of mine who's another writer remarked, he said, now these people are out of the woods and they're out on the main street. They're out on they're fine. They're emboldened to do this kind of thing. And that's kind of what I saw at the Neshoba County Fair. As far as the good old boy, what Drake was talking about, is there are all these kind of local political rallies. Y'all have these in Tennessee, but you also have these in Mississippi, which is, you know, local county politicians will have a chicken dinner, and you have these people come in and give stump speeches and talk and, you know, back slapping and all that stuff. And again, I mean, it is worrisome. I mean, I think it's a strange time that people are not looking over. I miss being a reporter. I really do. I miss the investigative work. I miss looking at the county budgets. I miss looking at the, you know, what's happening with the city. Where are your tax dollars being spent? And people need to be held accountable. They really do. I talked really bad about you while you were gone.
Thank you. Used to it. A simple question. The packaging of this book, when I got it, I went, it's so bright.
Yeah.
The previous eight have been greenish, black, darkish.
Yeah.
Decision made consciously.
No, I have nothing to do with the packaging, the overall look of the book. In fact, somebody mentioned, they said, boy, this book is so big. You know,
right.
It's thick. They thought it was going to be like, you know, two times the length of the previous books. It's actually the same word count. It's just the way that it's
Thank
laid
God.
Out. It's the way the way it looks, you know, is completely different. But it is interesting. If you guys listen to audiobooks and books on tape, they really did a bang-up job on this
one. Who reads
it? Well, it's a guy named... McLeod Andrews, and he's just terrific, and he's a great reader, and he does Quinn and all those characters. But as we mentioned earlier, part of the story is dealing with podcasters and them telling a separate story of something that happened years ago. So there's actually a podcast section. So when you listen to the book, you can hear another narrator, a woman's voice, is being interspersed with actually the tale.
Oh, really?
Novel. So it's really clever. It was something that the producers came to me and they said,
is that
would
new?
You be okay with this? Yeah, totally new. Yeah, very, very interesting. Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, that is good. Yes, sir, Tom.
Ask her first.
Hey, Myra Ann. Myra is a long friend of mine. A long friend of mine. She's short, really. A long time. Who is a big Ace fan. Who even... what was the book where, what's her name, threw a knife at Quinn and it stuck in the wall?
It was probably, I think, maybe the fall.
Well, Ophelia. The coroner. So Myra had him autograph a knife.
Yeah.
That's how distorted her view of life is. Yes, dear. She's from El Dorado, Arkansas.
Oh, okay.
And I sent her a picture of like page six with El Dorado.
Yeah.
I thought,
yeah.
Where'd he come up with that?
Where did that come from?
Are you talking about the Mexican restaurant? You know, that's the thing about
no,
Arkansas.
Where Twilight's mother was from.
Oh, okay.
It's
there's
a little thing, but it's El Dorado.
Well, I mean,
I grew up there. But
Elder, I mean, you can't make up a name like El Dorado. Arkansas.
El Camino, same thing.
For a writer, that's just comedy gold right there. You know, I've got to seize upon that right there. But I love all these towns, these little names. I mean, there's a place in Mississippi called Hot Coffee, Mississippi. I mean, I got to write a place. There's a place called Pocahontas, Mississippi. I got to write about those places. I like the sound of the words. I like something. So that's how it came about. But that's a woman that was working as a, I would like to say, as an exotic dancer. That was her hometown. So
a belly dancer.
Yeah, a belly dancer. Yeah, yes. Yes, sir.
Okay, the question comes back. Let's go back over who you are, because you basically came out of Alabama, you went down to Florida, you drug your feet through New Orleans,
right?
Which I'm disappointed you don't like that character. And you ran it through Clark through the Delta, and you ended up in Mississippi. Why did you? How did you manage to end up in Mississippi as your focal point for books?
Well, that's a really good question, Tom, and I appreciate that. So I'm originally, you know, I always tell people, which is not that strange for people who are from this area. It's like, where are you from? Are you from Mississippi? I'm like, well, part of my family's from Mississippi, but I'm originally from Alabama, which is not really that huge culturally, you know, not a big difference. But I ended up in Mississippi coming to Ole Miss to teach journalism. And so this is about 20 years ago. I was invited to come in and teach a class on feature writing and investigative reporting and that kind of thing. And I never ended up staying, but I've always been fascinated by Memphis, and I've always been fascinated by the Mid-South. And I remember when I was in college, I came just to take a just a pilgrimage to come here and see where Stax Studios used to be, and to come here and see Sun Studios, and to see where
America Studios.
Just it is. It's just the epicenter for many people of Americana, and I think when people that are from overseas, they want to come to America, Memphis is ground zero. And I think for me as a novelist, even going back to the early books, and I don't want to not write about that character. I would gladly write about that character in that world of writing more about music and that kind of thing. I just think that, you know, like the Quinn Colson books has a little bit of a broader appeal. It's, I can write more about different events and different issues. But I think Memphis and the Mid-South is just like currency in the world. It's people want to know about this area. This is like, you know, the center of the country. This is where people talk about the birth of rock and roll. They talk about the Deep South. We are in it. We are right here in the mix. This is the cultural hub of the Deep South. And so as a writer, I wanted to be here. I wanted to be in the middle of it, you know. I think Alabama is interesting, but Mississippi is like Alabama on steroids.
HGH. But as a writer, I think it is an impressive task that you do this, what you just said, and then you will wander off to Boston and wander those streets and go to all the right places.
Yeah.
And you dealt with Joan Parker, Bob's wife, and you capture Boston as perfectly as you do this. Although this is a little more complex, because there's a lot of, well, it's just more screwed up. Although Boston's not perfect, but you, it's a kind of a, you have to go from one to the other extreme,
yeah,
to write the books properly. And you do that very well. And I wonder if you ever get tired of it, and if you had to choose, I'm guessing you would choose Mississippi because it's even more messed up than Boston.
I think there's a question that's talking about, you know, changing the venues, and it's much easier talking to y'all about Mississippi and Memphis and whatever, because these are all my people and these connections, that kind of thing. But when I go to Boston, I think I've told the story before, but I always get that damn question. It's like, hey, Mr. Atkins, let me ask you a question. You know, I'm like, you know, Fred from Quincy, let me tell you something. You're from Mississippi. How are you writing Boston? You know, what are you doing? And I said, look, I've told this joke before, but I'd say I'm not from Mississippi. You know, I said, I've only lived there for the last 15, 20 years. You know, I came there just to teach, and I ended up staying there. Like, oh, thank God, I thought you were from Mississippi. Oh, my God. And I said, actually, I'm from Alabama. And so that really throws them off. But I think that the reason I was hired by the Parker Estate is, you know, I come from the same place as Bob Parker. My training, my background is in classic detective fiction. It's what I always wanted to do. It's what my love is. Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, Elmore Leonard, John D. McDonald. This is what I wanted to do. And what I really wanted to do was to take that world the way that John D. McDonald would write about Florida, or different writers would write about different parts of the country and bring it to other people. That's what the crime novel does. You know, people ask me, why do you write a crime novel? Why don't you write a, you know, a book of a coming of age story or somebody finding themselves or some kind of crap like that? And I said, you know, the great thing about the crime novel is to explore the territory that you live in and to talk about that world and talk about that. And that's the thing I could bring to the table, is I could bring to the Deep South. I mean, I'm from the Deep South. Both my parents are from the Deep South. We're steeped in the stuff, and I think it's an interesting world. I think people want to learn about it. So that's how I ended up here, and that's what I love to write about. But Boston is a challenge. I will say this. I would not be writing these books if it had not been for somebody like Robert B. Parker. And I wanted to do for the Deep South what Robert B. Parker had done for Boston. So for me, it's kind of just paying him respect and paying him some honor.
It's important, I think, to point out briefly, because we live in a world where everybody has to be labeled something. Human beings do, and that's becoming a problem. If somebody asked me, what does Ace write about? I wouldn't know what, this is crime fiction, kinda.
Yeah.
It's a thriller, kinda. It's a whodunit, this time, indeed. It's a bunch of stuff. So the labels that used to apply immediately,
yeah,
to McDonald or to whomever,
yeah,
they're much broader, and I couldn't call this anything.
Yeah.
It's not fact or fiction, it's, yeah, everything in one. And the labeling of books is more dangerous than the people labeling, I think. I mean, yeah. There's a lot going on here that you can't just define in two words.
Yeah.
Your thoughts?
Well, and then we'll perhaps maybe wrap it up.
What, are you tired of me?
No, not tired of you. You and I are continuing on. You're not done with me for the rest of the night. I think the people, they may be a little tired of listening to me. I think that it's all the same. Storytelling is storytelling. And I don't think that, you know, there are labels, you know, is this, you know, what kind of fiction, what kind of book it is, whatever. You know, it's like Duke Ellington said. He said, there's two kinds of music. There's good and bad. I'm just telling a story. I don't know what it is. You know, is it a Western? Is it a Southern novel? Is it a thriller? I don't know. I write what I like. And I think that's what I always tell people when they talk about writing or books that they want to read or whatever is, you know, I write the kind of books that I want to read. And so I'm inspired by everything from Robert Penn Warren, William Faulkner, to Dashiell Hammett, to Raymond Chandler, to, you know, it's all the same. I'm inspired by Waylon Jennings, and I'm inspired by all kinds of cultural stuff. It all goes into it. Joan Jett. I love Joan Jett. I go into all these different things that inspired me as a kid. And, you know, one of the people I bring up all the time is Burt Reynolds. I love those movies. I love Burt Reynolds. I love White Lightning. I love Smoking the Bandit.
Gator,
you know, and I like that, you know, we need, like, that's what kind of the genesis of this whole thing was, is my, you know, I've been writing, you guys who've been here for many years, and I really appreciate that and have supported me for many years, is I wrote 4 true crime novels and books that are based on true stories. And then my editor said, hey, you know, you probably could make a lot more money if we had a serious character that we could write about. And I said, yeah, and I kind of thought about that. I said, what could I bring to the table that was different? You know, what could I bring that was interesting? And it really brought me back to Burt Reynolds. And I thought about, like, when I was a kid, I was proud to be from the South, to have that connection when I watch a movie like White Lightning or Gator or something like that, or Sharky's Machine. I was like, he was like the hero of the New South, and he was taking on corruption and greed and all that stuff. And I said, I'm going to do a character that, like, Burt Reynolds would have been perfect in that role. And I was fortunate, years later, Burt actually read my books, and I'd get really nice notes for him. I ended up writing I was supposed to go down and meet him. He was one of my heroes, and I was supposed to go down and meet him last year. And the schedules kind of got mixed up because I was trying to finish a book, and he had just gotten on to work on the new Tarantino movie. He was supposed to be in it, and he died suddenly. And I ended up writing a piece.
Look it up. It's really, really good.
Yeah, I wrote a piece about him for Garden of Gun.
It's fantastic.
It was very, very heartfelt because I really felt like what he brought to Southerners and what he brought to the image of the South and what we stood for and what everything is what I hope to accomplish with these books. So it's everything, you know, it's the music, it's the landscape, it's all of it. And it's a lot of fun. And I can't tell you guys how much I appreciate the support, because there damn well would not be 9 books if people weren't buying them. So thank you guys very much.
One last question. This morning you came into the station and you were wearing a hat with an A on it.
Yeah.
Because you were an Auburn football star. What is the difference in the Auburn A, the Alabama A, and the Arkansas A? It's really getting on my nerves.
You know, I'm going to confuse you even further, Drake. The hat I was wearing was actually for a minor league baseball team called the Reno Aces. And I heard about this team called the Reno Aces. And I was like, I got to have a hat for that.
Never mind.
Listen, Drake, you have been supporting me since the very beginning. I think we first, maybe the Ranger. Maybe it was the first thing that we started being on the show, maybe before that.
Parker, but maybe, I'm not sure.
No, I think Parker came later.
Okay.
And doing Spencer books. But anyway, you've been a big supporter of Quinn Colson. I could not do this without you. I appreciate you spreading the word. You are a good friend, you're a good ally, and I appreciate it very much. So thank you.
Hi, Craig. Thank you, sir. I really can't, you know, fake this stuff, so if I didn't care about you and how good you are, I wouldn't do it, because it's way past my bedtime, but we're drinking, so who cares? Books to be purchased, questions to be asked, books to be signed.
Here we are. Atkins. I think are we over here?
Over there.
Do you want to be?
Wherever.
I was going to set us up right here.
We'll set up it right here. It sounds
okay.
Good.
All right, so don't touch my stuff.
So, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you all. Thank you all very much.
And
line up,
right,
sign up, and
we're
get your deals right.
Go.
Thank you.
Bert, I'll be right back. All right.